Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm your host, Donna Loring. This series will focus on the hidden elements that have influenced Wabanaki history from the invasion of our shores in the 18th century to the land claims and beyond. Today, we will be talking with author Rebecca Claren, an investigative journalist, about her latest work, The Cost of Free Land, Jews, Lakota, and an American Inheritance. Our other guests today are Professor Harold Prince, Dutch citizen of the Netherlands, distinguished professor of anthropology and emeritus at the University of Kansas. Professor Darren Ranko, a member of the Penobscot Nation and professor of anthropology and chair of Native American Studies at the University of Maine. Rebecca's book, The Cost of Free Land, investigates how 20th century federal policies that gave her ancestors, Jews fleeing oppression in Russia, free land on the South Dakota prairie and a pathway to the middle class came at great cost to the Lakota neighbors. The book not only retells this entangled history, but grapples with what can be done to reconcile the past. Welcome to the show, Rebecca. And I want to start off by having you tell us about your book and how you came to write it.
Wonderful. Well, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me. This book really started with three questions. What are the stories we tell in families and in nations? What are the stories we don't tell? And why in particular don't we tell the stories we don't tell? So, for example, I grew up hearing these amazing stories that were very beloved by me about my ancestors who were Jewish homesteaders on the South Dakota prairie in the early 1900s. There was the one about my Uncle Louie, who could stand on the back of a horse, who was a Bronco rider. There was the one about my cousin, who when he was only 5 years old, every morning, this is the family lore, he would clear a path of rattlesnakes between the house and the outhouse. And the one that's like our greatest hit, that especially the women in my family love to tell, is about my great-great-grandmother, Fagetka, who she was very religious and it was important to her to maintain her Jewish traditions and rituals. So in the winter in South Dakota, when it can be like negative 60, she would send my great-grandmother and her sister Rose outside armed with a stick or an axe and tell them to crack the ice of the creek that ran behind their house. And then Fagetka would strip naked and dunk herself in this cold water. This was her mikveh, which is a Jewish ritual to mark the end of your menstrual cycle. For all these stories that we loved and that we talked about, there were never any stories about my family's Lakota neighbors. The closest Lakota reservation was only 13 miles from the northern part of my family's land. And it took me a long time, kind of an embarrassingly long time, to start to notice that, to see the way we were leaving a lot of white space at the edges of the stories we told. I've been a journalist writing about the American West for 25 years. And during that time, I have written over time about Native nations. And it was at one point I was hired by an investigative nonprofit out here in the Northwest where I live to write a whole series about kind of contemporary issues affecting Native nations, Native individuals. And it was important to me to connect what's happening now to former federal policies that have impacted nations and also have left a real legacy. And it was while working on that series that I just had this very slow dawning realization that this history is not outside of my own personal story, that this is my personal history, because since my ancestors were homesteaders, my family, I myself have benefited from the dispossession of Native land. I had an excellent education. I grew up in the Northwest. I went to college on the East Coast. I don't think I ever was taught about what happened to Native people in our country based on federal policies of genocide and cultural genocide, attempted cultural genocide. And So to me, I wanted to write this book that wasn't just about the past, but that connected what has happened to this contemporary moment. So the book toggles back and forth between the historical events that I'm sharing, but also with what's happening today in my family today, in Lakota families today, on the Standing Rock Reservation, on the Cheyenne River Reservation, which is where the two reservations closest to where my family's land was. And I also felt like when, if we are taught in school, I'm going to speak for all Americans here, but if we are taught the history of immigrants or the history of Jewish Americans or the history of Native Americans or the history of the Lakota, we are usually taught these histories in silos. And that's why I wanted to write this as much as I could in this entangled way, because to me, if you tell these histories separately, you really miss the depth of the injustice. You miss the way the United States very clearly crafted policies and laws that would help certain groups at great cost to Native people. How did this work? You know, my family, this book, because I wanted to do this with as much context and nuance as possible, the book doesn't actually start in South Dakota. It's chapter one begins in Russia, which is where my family had been living before they came to America as Jews. Living in what was then called the Pale of Settlement. They didn't call it a reservation, they called it the Pale of Settlement. It was this area where Jews primarily had to live, and they were subject to all sorts of economic constraints while living there, as well as real threats to their bodies. And my great-great-grandfather, Harry Sinikin, was in a terrible pogrom where he was beaten to within an inch of his life and left for dead. And he wasn't, my family, they weren't allowed to own guns as Jews or any weapons at all. They were restricted from having certain kinds of jobs. My great-great-grandfather was a smith, but he couldn't work with gold or silver. Those were too fancy for Jews. He could only work with tin. And so when many Jews start to get the opportunity to come to America, to leave Russia, my family gets on that big wave of people coming to America. And part of why my family comes is because there's free land on offer. Now, did my family connect the dots about why this land was on offer? Hard to say. What I don't know if they understood was the fact that, just a quick history lesson, the United States in around 1851, 1850, California becomes a state with this raft of natural resources. And the trains, the railroads, which are the biggest corporations, most powerful corporations of their time, want to connect a rail line connecting California to the East Coast. But inconveniently for the railroads, problematically for them, in the midst of all that land where they would want to place track, are millions of buffalo and land that has been reserved for Native nations under federal treaty, the highest law of the land, an agreement signed between those nations and the United States. And so promises made very quickly become promises broken. There's a map in the front of my book where I try and show and demonstrate the way in a visual form that the land of the Lakota in particular is dispossessed in like a 60-year period between 1851, when the Lakota first signed their first treaty with the United States. And by the time my family is living on what had very recently been Lakota land, the United States break treaties, steal land, take land. I use those terms intentionally. It has been, in some places, it's like clear theft. In some cases, it's, you could call it legal theft, but they are working at least under the legal arrangement that the United States has itself set out for how to break treaties and amend those agreements. But the bottom line is, based on my research, by the time my family is settling on their land in 1908, the Lakota Nation is living on just 2% of the land that it had reserved would be theirs for perpetuity. Just less than 60 years earlier. To make this land available, the railroads knew that the cost of shipping from the California all the way to the East Coast, that long haul traffic would not cover the cost of a rail line. They needed lots of little communities and settlements along the rail ride that those smaller costs to bring dry goods out, to ship cattle to market. That's what would cover the cost of the railroad line. And so the United States is doing the bidding of the railroads in some part, and they create homesteads. They take this land from the Lakota, they give it away for free to primarily white or white enough people who become homesteaders. They get 160 acres that is theirs to keep if they can, quote unquote, tame the wild prairie, improve the land. We now know that one of the major ways to capture carbon and fight climate change is to have a very succinct, working, functioning native prairie ecosystem. But at the time, it looked to the United States as if that land was just sitting around doing nothing. So homesteaders were charged to dig it up, turn it into farmland, build a structure on the house. For my ancestors, this opportunity was amazing. When they were immigrants in Russia, they were not allowed to own land. So owning land allowed them to shake off their suspect immigrant status. They told their children, and their children have told me, that they felt more free for this opportunity. And it also gave them, I had all these family stories, but I wanted, because I'm trained as an investigative reporter, I wanted something resembling a fact. And so to do that, I pulled every single deed that my family owned on that land. By the 1950s, we owned like a 6,000 acre cattle ranch. And then I pulled every mortgage that was taken out on that land. And when I compared, I had all these timelines that I created and Excel spreadsheets. And when I compared the dates on the mortgages and what I was learning from letters and photographs and newspaper clippings that told me what was happening in my family's life, you see this very clear pattern of they would take out a mortgage and then they would buy more land, or they would take out a mortgage and they would start a business that wasn't reliant on weather. My family gets very into the saloon business in the Black Hills. Or they would move. They would keep their land, but they'd move to a more cosmopolitan, bigger city. I did a lot of math and figured out that those, like, quote unquote, free land, those little bits of mortgages over time, in today's dollars, the amount of money my family got out of that land was $1.1 million. So it had this really huge, important, both psychological and economic impact. But in the meantime, their Lakota neighbors very close by are not only having their land taken away, this whole effort to further diminish Lakota and other native connection to land results, as you all know, in this policy of, let's take children away and put them in federal boarding school. Let's make their religion and culture and language illegal to practice. And it's a horrible history that has a huge legacy today. And I am the beneficiary of that, like many, many Americans. Just say one more thing before we go to questions and conversation. I think it's important to include here that as many as 25% of American adults living today descend from homesteaders. That's as many as potentially 90, over 90 million people. And there's a sociologist out of Berkeley, Mark Shapiro, and he wrote a book about wealth and inequality. And he says, if you are a descendant of a homesteader and you can send your children to college without loans, you own a home, you own a second home, it is probable that you can do that because your ancestors were homesteaders. It's been called one of the biggest affirmative action policies for white people ever done in the history of America.
Okay, well, thank you for that explanation. And there's a lot of synergy here. Reference land ownership and sovereignty and cycles of oppression, I think. And so I'm going to go to Darren, Professor Ranko first. Darren.
Thanks, Donna. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us today. And this work is really important. I want to hear a little bit more, maybe about your personal sort of journey through it. I mean, you glossed it in a really nice way, and it's sort of like before I didn't know, and now I'm enlightened, and then sort of like, you know, that sort of thing. And I, and I'll just give you some context. I'm working, and the other two are not as involved in this work as I am, but I'm working on land return and rematriation work out here. And we're working with land trusts and conservation groups, that many of whom were testifying against our sovereignty just like a decade or more ago. And now there are partners in land return. And I guess, you know, one of the things that comes up when we have just like the native side of these meetings is like, how can we trust them? Like, they seem to want to help us now where they didn't before, but they come to some of the same understandings that you have. Like, they've learned through, and we have partners who have gone into the history and tried to break down the silos that you mentioned. Like, the history of conservation, as you know, is not divorced from the very painful histories of takings of our lands as Indigenous people. And often, you know, parks are created by kicking Indigenous people out. All the things that they're learning, many of them, shockingly or not so shockingly, for the first time, and then really seeing a kind of responsibility given their what they've benefited from. And then also, as you mentioned, recognizing the genius of Indigenous science and land management skills that create a better set of ecosystem resilience in the face of climate change, all the things that you kind of hinted at there. So I guess, like, you know, how does that, you know, we're always trying to figure out, like, how do you go from that knowledge into the action space? And as a writer, I feel like you deal with in audiences too, in a different, you know, as a reporter, like, you're trying to shape audiences and sort of their understandings and then their actions. You know, I mean, we're super inspired by, for example, up in Seattle, right? There's like the Duwamish are saying, pay your rent, you know, these kinds of things. And I guess just getting you to reflect upon that you're part of a cohort of descendants of settlers that are examining these things in a really truthful and brave way. And I guess sort of, you know, what is in the air, or what is it that you kind of account for that? And how do we get more people engaged in that? I mean, I hate sort of saying, like, as an educator, like, oh, they just knew, because that's not enough, honestly, right? That there's something else about this that beyond them just knowing that they have a legacy that is standing on the backs of so much suffering and harm. And so I guess, yeah, just your thoughts on that, because it's, your voice is so vibrant in that space. And I've never had enough drinks with land trust people to try to really figure out where they're at and why they transformed from like not trusting us and our sovereignty to being like, no, let's get all the land back for you. Like, I mean, that seems like a pretty radical shift. So I'm just like trying to understand it.
That's amazing. I love that. That is so amazing. And it makes entire sense to me that you would have that question of, can we count on these people? Is it trustworthy? And I take that in a deep way. I want to start by saying, it's not like I know everything now. Like you sort of said, like, I feel like I am less dumb than I used to be. So I think that's a really important place to start for myself. I love what an elder in the Dakotas, Faith Spotted Eagle. She's a really incredible, you're nodding, you know who she is. She talks about how when non-Native people and Native people learn this history together, for the Native individual, it's healing. But for the non-Native person, it is freedom from denial. And I love that phrase so much. And I have experienced it and seen it in my own family, that people, first of all, there's sort of this, the way we tell the stories of our relatives is, oh, she was so perfect. Look at how great she looked in all the photos we have of her. She never fought. She was so kind. And that's, it's inspiring, but it is it's a hard raw edge to hold, right? Like, it's hard then, if that's the truth, then when you look around at your current, when I look around at my current family and there's all sorts of mishigas, that's a Yiddish word for like craziness, then you start to think, oh, we were bad and they were good. And so there's this freedom from denial can happen on so many levels, but on this very personal level, which I think for me is an important piece to include here, knowing the much more complicated, messy history of my relatives has been freeing. It helps me and my cousins feel more compassionately towards ourselves and each other and our ancestors. And it's hard. There's grief, real grief that has come up for me and my relatives in these stories being aired. And I think you could take that writ large. There is so much grief for us to hold about the truer story of America than the one we ever talk about. We as non-Native people, of course, Native people, you know this and live this grief. But I think it's also freeing because if you're a thinking person, you know that there's something off here. And I have seen it when I talk to kids. I mean, they get it. They want, and I think that's, of course, why we haven't taught that history, because the next step is so often, well, what are we supposed to do about that? Everyone wants to know. So I think my own sense of how did I get here, partly it's because I come from a Jewish tradition. I've been taught my whole life this idea of tikkun olam, repair the world, that we're all here to try and fix the world. And every layer of my tradition is teaching about that sense of taking personal responsibility to do your part, that you don't, that it's not on you to fix everything, but it's not also allowed for you to do nothing. And so that is, I think I have been primed as a person in my, you know, growing up for big ears for that. But also it's just the fact of spending more and more time with Native elders. I've learned so much. And I think you can't learn, you can't hear these stories again and again without, I mean, in my experience, they changed me. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, I mean, I know it's an impossible question. I just, you lending voice to that, you know, just helps us. I mean, I think the magical pieces of it, you know, for us in our work is going together through that, like, and allowing some space for some, you know, mistakes. And, you know, I think it's a process that, you know, requires some real resilience on all sides, like some real commitments. And on the Native side too. I mean, you mentioned like, we kind of know and live this, but yeah, there's enough denial in our, you know, I mean, it's not like there's a universal consciousness, if only there were amongst Native people. But
go ahead.
No, just for me, it's like, you know, how to engage that in the spaces together, but also we're independent for interdependent, you know, at times in this collective work, and realizing what we can and cannot do on our own and with each other. For me, I mobilize we have great diplomacy traditions here in terms of Wabanaki. We have a confederacy. So, you know, where we can operate both together, but also as independent entities coming together. And I think we really mobilize that. But I think, I just so appreciate your honesty with it. And, you know, that change piece is something I'm really trying to tap into, and I'm glad you're also doing it, because I think your experiences are really special. So just wanted to thank you for that. Yeah.
That means so much. Thank you for saying that. I mean, I love what you said about making mistakes, because I think that's not talked about enough. It made me, you know, I write in the book, like I had at some point in my career gotten used to sort of being the dumb white woman in the room, like that, to listen, and I knew I had more to learn, but it's still, there's such shame of doing it wrong and feeling afraid of doing it wrong. And a friend of mine who is Jewish but works in California with the Native Land Trust, he said, you're gonna make mistakes. There's no way to take risk big enough in this work to do anything without, you're gonna make a mistake to do that. But that's okay. That's part of it. And you just have to trust that when you make a mistake, you ask for forgiveness and people will grant it to you and you go forward along. And that brought me a lot of, it helped. It was soothing to me to be told that.
Yeah. And I think also in your work, there's this like, you know, one of the things we talk about is that the future of our territory, what is now called Maine and Northern New England and the Eastern provinces of Canada, like, it's not the past that is Wabanaki, but the future, right? I mean, and I feel like you hold out hope that there is also an Indigenous future, which is one of the fundamental kind of axiomatic points that sort of dehumanizes us as Indigenous people as only past, right? And I think,
yes,
you know, that idea that you looking back into your personal history and thinking that through of like, what is the future of the West? I think in a broader sense is also really important to our work. You know, now I'm just testifying, but Donna will talk.
No,
I know Harry will have more specific historical questions to draw that out, but I just wanted to make that connection in the contemporary moment because you're speaking to, I think, a process. We're not the only group of tribes, you know, working on land return right now, right?
Absolutely.
There's something out there going on, and you mentioned land trust, you know, a native land trust. So I think there's part of a possibility of reflection. You know, we always, again, through mistrust, I don't know why that comes through, but through mistrust, like, we're like, is this just a moment and we're going to lose it? Is the backlash worse than the progress and all that? But I think we are in this moment, and I think your voice is, it really is lending to that. So I appreciate it.
That means so much. I mean, I kept at one point when the book wasn't done, but I taught a class with my rabbi about sort of, so sorry, just to give some context here. Before this was even a book that I was writing, when it was just an idea, I was with Judge Abby Abenanti, who is a Yurok elder and a chief justice of her nation. And also she's a former superior court judge for the state of California. And she's so admired, and, you know, in native and non-native circles. And she said to me, if you're going to look and tell these histories, you really need to grapple with them. And you should do that through your own culture. What did the Jews say about how to respond to a harm, even one that you didn't directly commit, but something you benefited from? And that sent me on this like several years course of study with my rabbi here in Portland, Benjamin Barnett. And we studied ancient Jewish texts, the Torah and the Talmud, the places that where those books are talking about atonement and repair and, you know, how do you do this? And the rabbi always just kept saying to me, how do you find yourself in this story? And when we taught this class to our members of our congregation, there were so many well-meaning people here. They'd signed up for the class. They thought of themselves as anti-racists, but they were really thinking of the history of native land dispossession as a societal issue. That's what they called it, that it had nothing to do with them. And we kept saying, how do you find yourself here? I think that is, to me, very important, because as we know, everyone living in America today has benefited from the taking of native land. It is a history that, like, you know, maybe if your family arrived here on slave ships, or if you got here last year, your distance to this history is different than mine as a descendant of homesteaders, but we all benefit. And so I feel like that to me is a very important thing that I've been seeing as I've been traveling around. I've done so many events, and there have been so many people who come up to me and said, you know, my family were homesteaders, and until this moment, it never occurred to me where our land actually came from. And so seeing that those lights come on has been really exciting, of people finding themselves. So
thanks, Rebecca. I'll hand it over to
thank you,
my pal Harold.
Harold?
Actually, if you don't mind, Donna, I was much more interested in what you would have to say at this joint juncture.
What I would say?
Yeah.
No, I really enjoy seeing this conversation unfold, because what my really favorite part is, Rebecca, where you talk about building a house or whatever, a foundation, that piece, that plank. You want to talk about that? Might as well
sure.
Do it.
That's my kid's favorite part of the book, too.
Yeah.
There's this ancient story in the Talmud, which is part of the Talmud, is just this collection of conversations between rabbis and disagreements, really. And there's this old story about these two rabbis are talking, like, what do you do if it's discovered that a house or even a palace was built using a stolen beam as its foundation? And one rabbi says, you have to tear that whole house down and give the beam back. And the other rabbi, the far more pragmatic, the one we usually listen to, his name is Hillel, he says, you don't have to tear the house down, but you have to pay the full value of that beam to whoever it was taken from. And this teaching, there's a wonderful sermon that Rabbi Sharon Brouse of Ikar in Los Angeles, she wrote a sermon that your listeners could find on the internet. It was for Rosh Hashanah one year. And she said, our country was built on a stolen beam. And so the question is, what do we do about it? Because both rabbis make it clear that once it is known, neither one says, if you don't know, you know, once you know that this has happened, that your house or your palace is built with a stolen beam, you have to do something. You have to make amends. That's very clear in the Talmud.
Well, I like the rest of the story too, is if, I forget if there's, it has to do with who's to blame. If there's a,
oh, you mean the one about the murdered victim in the road?
Yeah,
I love that one. So this is the teaching from Deuteronomy in the Torah. These ancient Israelites, they didn't even have rabbis then, but this idea that if they lived in small groups of people, and what happens if it's discovered that a murdered person, the body is found and no one knows who did the killing? What they would do is they would measure their distance. The communities closest to the corpse would measure their distance to the corpse. And whichever community was closer, they would take the responsibility to not only bury the body, but to do a ritual that I look at the ritual, I'm like, that ritual has economic impact to this group of people who are living in a dry place. They had to kill one of their animals. And that is that the ritual was done to purify the space. And Rabbi Toba Spitzer, who's a wonderful rabbi in Massachusetts, she writes in a sermon she wrote about this teaching, you know, this teaches us that sin is social, and it not only has a polluting effect to everyone in the community, but that also the community itself can take responsibility. We can do this even if we're not the murderer, and we should. And she writes in her sermon, which is another wonderful one, you know, our country was built on twin original sins. And she names the enslaving of humans and the taking and theft of native land.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of the creation of the state of Maine. How Maine actually came into being because of the Missouri Compromise, you know, like, we will be a non-slave state to balance it. And then the piece where Massachusetts agreed to let Maine be a state if they took over the obligations of the treaties. So it's, you know, Maine is sort of like a microcosm of this stuff. And I'm glad that we're talking about this paying back of wrongs. Mm-hmm. And I think we're there here in Maine, we're starting to be. You know, Darren does this work, which as he said, you know, Harold and I don't at least I don't know about Harold, but I don't. I do other things. But you know, I mean, it doesn't make any of our work less important. It just makes we all help each other in what we do. So Harold, come on, say something here.
I actually was struck by your search for facts. You had the stories. some of the good, some of the mythologizing stories, the legends, some of which pieces were true, probably some other pieces were invented, but they were great stories. But then you wanted facts, and you went through mortgages. You looked at the land, you looked at the mortgage that was taken out on the land as a collateral, and what that money that then was taken out from the bank, how your great-grandfather and grandfather and uncles, how they began to use the term, capitalize on the land. And so it was a fascinating phenomenon. If you think about your Lakota neighbors who would not have commodified that land, to which they have a very different relationship than the people who have just come in from Southern Europe, Southeastern Europe, from the Odessa area, where they didn't have land, but they realized that land had a value, a market value with a price and a value that then could be used as a collateral to capitalize and increase the capital to some total that you calculated, something like 1.1 million came out of that small piece of land, relatively small piece of land. Lakota would not have been socialized, of course, into that kind of thinking, how that land could work for you in the form of currency with interest and productivity. And that's, of course, a major reason why in the dispossession of indigenous lands, when entrepreneurs who acquired huge tracts of land, whether it was a railroad company, which often typically would buy up a huge amount, that's usually about a kilometer or so on both sides of the railroad track, because that would be the most valuable piece of land when these railroads would be constructed. And it was not just in the Great West where your ancestors settled, but also in Argentina, for example, and also in Paraguay. And what you then see is people who have made huge money, and I'm talking here about the Baron de Rothschild, in Germany, but also Baron Maurice de Hirsch, also a German, although his name sounds more French. But they made huge fortunes in the railroad companies to access the mines for the extraction of resources, and then began to use their gigantic capital to alleviate the suffering of oppressed Jews in the Pale, right? Both in the southern Russia and Ukraine area, but also in Poland and Northern Czech Republic, was now Northern Czech Republic area. And so that's how you see in many far-flung parts of the world, at the end of railroad lines, you see these communities emerge whereby land that was taken, robbed, however you want to talk about the dispossession, but that land would be then commodified. And that's exactly in the interest, of course, also of the big landowners, because once that land has been put to use, you get a store, you get a school, and therefore all the surrounding property that wasn't given away is increasing in value. And that phenomena you see in Argentina, Paraguay, but you also saw it in Palestine. As you know, when the Jewish National Fund began to acquire land in what was then the Ottoman Empire, and later during the Palestine Mandate under British control, was large amounts of land. I think a total of 13% of the state of Israel was purchased by the Jewish National Fund, but it came from marginal land, or who knows how the local Bedouins were compensated or not, local fishermen were dispossessed or not, I do not know. But I lived in one of those areas under the in the shadow of the Golan Heights on the east bank of Mount of Lake of Galilee, where you had one of these tower and palisade settlements called Ein Gev. It became a kibbutz in 1937. And so when you begin to look at these larger structural issues away from what Darren and Donna were kind of focusing, more your own journey, I'm more interested in the larger structural capitalist components of the resettlement and the dispossession of land. And just to wrap it up on my part, back to Maine, we see that, of course, in Waldo County, whereby in the indigenous peoples were dispossessed in a series of Anglo-Wabanaki wars, then this became the frontier about roughly where now the Penobscot River is, between French colonial and British colonial interests. And then the land that was claimed on dubious grounds by Samuel Waldo, he then needed, after the land was cleared, in quotation marks, of indigenous peoples, he needed then settlers. So he had his son go to Germany all the way up the Rhine River and had these recruitment posts to get German Protestant settlers into Maine, often on false promises, but with given free land, usually about 120 acres per head of family. And later, even in the 1870s, you see that in northern Maine, in the so-called unceded Maliseet territories, whereby the Maliseet never had a treaty with the state of Maine until 1980, through the Maine Indian Land Claim Settlement Act, that in northern Maine, the colony of New Sweden was founded, whereby again, a Maine politician saw that the Irish made bad settlers, but Swedes were great. And of course, we know that Trump has basically recently said a similar kind of thing about people who are coming from the so-called shit countries. I think that was, I'm now quoting him, but he basically said, why don't we get Norwegian settlers here? And so this Maine politician, who was the Speaker of the House in the, I think in the 1870s, but went to Sweden to recruit settlers into for a township just northeast of Caribou. And it's just fascinating to see that at about the same time, the Passamaquoddy, who were fighting to protect their land, were being denied by the Maine Supreme Court that they even had a status as a tribe. It was Louis Mitchell. We discussed that with Darren and with Donna in an earlier session. It was about the same time that the Penobscot and Passamaquoddy see their tribal status being questioned so that the state of Maine would not have to fulfill its treaty obligations toward the tribes because they are no longer tribes. Therefore, the land could be taken away, which it was in many parts. And then at the same time, free land, quote unquote, was given to Swedish settlers in what is now New Sweden. And so it's a fascinating phenomenon that just begin to see whether you go to Argentina, Paraguay, Palestine, Maine, mm-hmm. or South Dakota.
Right. I mean, it's when you put it right next to each other, you really start to see those connections, right? Like I found this really fascinating journal article from early 1900s describing how clearly the railroads were trying to get Aryan and Nordic settlers on the plains. It was very clear. They were going to really Norway, Sweden, Germany, England to try and recruit. I think I want to make a point that I haven't made that it's important to me that for the listeners who are thinking, oh, all the Jews got all the land. No, my family story is in some ways very rare. There were about 1,000 Jewish homesteaders in the Dakotas. That accounts for about half of 1% of all homesteaders in the Dakotas. Most of them were not Jewish. And I would say the fascinating history you talked about with Baron de Hirsch Fund, for example, Baron de Hirsch was responding to terrible anti-Semitism as Jews like my family are coming to America. These spikes of anti-Semitism are happening on the East Coast. And all these German Jews who've been living in the country for decades could no longer send their kids to these fancy schools. And, you know, it's getting bad for everyone. So they do this thing called the solution to the Jewish problem, which is unfortunate they use that language, and they create these funds to get Jews out of the East Coast. And that's part of what sends Jews, as you're right, to Argentina. It's why many Jews end up in the West, although my family did not get in on that funding. And it's really so complicated. And here they're trying to solve a real problem of Jews being really oppressed. But this is a question I really thought about a lot in my book. What happens when you are oppressed and then you become an oppressor? You become part of this oppressor class, maybe unintentionally, but you are part of then a system that is oppressing others. And you see that, as you say, all over the world, really.
Yeah,
that's so true. Sorry, Donna, but that's so absolutely true. When I lived in Israel, coming from a Dutch Protestant family, which was extremely pro-Israel, I began to learn Hebrew and began to hear how the Israelis were talking about the Arabs and began to greatly disturb me. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I remember I worked in the copper mines in the Negev desert in the Red Sea. I was 18 years old and it was before college. I spent a year there. And I remember that the term Herrenvolk came to me. And I don't know if you know that term, it's a German term for the master race. And I thought, how is it possible that that supremacy idea of the Nazis, the Germans, whereby the Jews were regarded as the Untermensch, the subhumans, right, and were subsequently treated for extermination or for slave labor, how is it possible that they have brought that mentality to Palestine? And that was a great disturbing thing that I didn't even know what to do with. It just came in my mind. It was so disturbing that took me years to try to figure out what was happening there. And the wrestling that you describe, I greatly admired. I think Darren was just mentioning it earlier. I have great admiration for you, the way you've been tackling these issues without making claims that you know it all. There remains a certain humbleness, and I think that's important for all of us who are confronting the complexities of history.
Well, thank you. I certainly don't know it all. And I do feel like if you study history, that is the beauty of studying history, is it teaches you how much you didn't know, how much you still have to know. And in my experience, it leads to great compassion, frankly, like it, by studying deeply the histories of conflict, it messes with you enough that you start to, in my experience, feel more humble, feel less clear. I feel like social media is the opposite of history. Social media just affirms all of our, you know, worst instincts for binary, for knowing everything. I find it, I'm in a very interesting place, as you can imagine, as a Jewish person and as someone who has many Indigenous friends and organizations that I am interested in following. And, you know, just the other range, I am seeing, when we discuss Israel and Gaza and the West Bank, the way people are talking is just past each other. It's hard. Actually, all of it's hard for me, because it just feels so black and white, and it's not.
Yeah, I mean, I think that brings us back to that idea of, what do we do? You know, I think in the face of it, how we fashion a response to these very big questions about a history that we share. And while there is an active war on Gaza, you know, I mean, this is a space of dramatic, and as you mentioned, you know, it leads anyone who knows what's happening, it leads you to tears pretty quickly. I think the broader sense of like responsibility that we have in these spaces and these legacies, where structures of power and resources like stack up on particular sides and are hidden from plain view, and how dehumanizing language gets pulled into that mix, you know. And I mentioned the sort of dehumanization of being only in the past, but also there's all sorts of, as Harold mentioned, you know, just simply denying someone their humanity on some basic level. Sorry, I have a dog. I don't know if you can hear them barking, but that idea, how our ancestors and our future generations will listen to the way we dealt with these, you know, here, and sort of move through what they experience. I'm always shocked, like my dad's family is Native, and my mom is French Canadian, Quebecois origin. Many Native people in our part of the world have these mixed things, and you know, they're still kind of caught up in being so happy that they're white, you know, that they get to pass, because there's a while here that they didn't, but they have no reflection on an immigrant history. I mean, they're very anti-immigrant. And the idea that this is embodied in just two generations so that that can flip. And for them to kind of, you know, to speak to Harold's point, I mean, I'm not saying, you know, Quebecois and Jews, you know, I'm saying that's similar in terms of the thing, but it doesn't take more than a generation or two to forget what dehumanization and the possessiveness around whiteness can do. And I feel like, how do we operate in those spaces? Because I mean, they've all unfriended me on Facebook, for example, because I just casually, you know, point out some of the inherent contradictions of their points of view, given my shared family history with them, where they were denied access from any number of things because they didn't speak a language. They didn't, yes. they have no connection to that. They feel nothing in
I wonder. So I think about something that Judge Abby said to me that I think about all the time. And I think about it. She was talking about my family in America, but it clearly to me is how I think about what's happening in the Middle East. She said, first of all, I spent a lot of time wondering, like, what did my family know about what was happening to their Lakota neighbors? Because it's just white space, right? The thousands of pages of scanned letters that I have, no one talks about the Lakota. So I don't know what they thought. And she said, everyone knew what was happening to Indians. Everyone knew. And she said in the next breath, which is very compassionate and very much her style, she said, but when you're running for your life in terror, which is what your ancestors were doing when they came to America, you're not stopping to have a quick restorative justice conversation along the way. She said, it's going to take several generations of not living with what we now call trauma, which is the trauma for many of us of having parents or grandparents who are immigrants and the way those traumas get passed down. And she said, so it's appropriate that it's, and I'm third generation, right? I'm fourth and third. It was my great-great and my great-grandparents who were homesteaders. And she said, it, and also immigrants. And she said, it makes sense it's coming to you and your generation to step into this history and to see it. So I feel like a huge amount of personal despair in the thinking of what is happening in Israel and in Palestine and in Gaza and in the West Bank. They're just re-traumatizing themselves over and over again. They're in that trauma state. And how many generations, of course, there are people there who are fighting for things to be different and who are making connections and working towards it. And it's not a monolith of thinking in the region, but there's not enough of them and they don't have enough power. And how many generations will it take and at what cost to be in a place where they can start to make those connections and do what we talked about earlier, find themselves in this history, see their personal benefit at the cost of others and untangle that in a way that they don't feel so defensive. There's not their lizard. I think of it as like lizard brains. Like they're just, you're just traumatized and fighting for everything for your children to be safe, I guess, you know?
Yeah. I mean, your moves in the book towards the lessons in the Talmud, I mean, to me, part of the way out of the lizard brain kind of scenario would be the higher mind that all cultures have.
Yes.
It's a universal. I have a PhD in anthropology. I'm totally comfortable saying that. All cultures have that higher mind. You know, for us as Wabanaki people, we find it in our Confederacy, in our wampum teaching, you know, like all the things that meant that we weren't at constant war with one another, right? Yeah. This is our higher mind, and that's who we are. All cultures have that. And I feel like that's the, you know, whether it's a belief in God, I'm not even saying that. I think the lessons of the higher mind can contract independently from that. And I think for us, you know, how to get out of that trauma space, I guess, because if it's continually inflicting, you know, like, you know, that sort of, again, that almost like the lash backlash, like that, you know, what's going on in the Middle East, in Gaza right now, will play out. I mean, we don't have to look that far back to see this will play out over generations and it will make everyone less safe. So the idea that people can get out of that, you know, if your point is to win the war, the war is ongoing, the trauma is ongoing. So I think, you know, that's where the that appeal to our traditions in the higher mind space is so important. And I dare say that our maybe even my French Canadian relatives, they have Catholic understandings of responsibility to take care of the other, and you know, all the things that the teachings and to treat the stranger, all those things are the higher mind. It's hard to appeal to that when they are ginned up to be afraid of something that they dehumanize so quickly, you know.
Right. How do we take responsibility for one another, which is in saw all of our teachings, and see. And yet I think that the existential threat of climate change, if anything is going to drive us to see, we have to take responsibility for each other. None of us get out of this one without doing things differently. And obviously, it's obvious to me, and I'm assuming to you, that Indigenous teachings and leadership, there's such a deep, in many Indigenous cultures, I'm not an anthropologist, I feel uncomfortable saying all, but that there is a, the ones that I know, the Native Nations, there is such a responsibility to, as my friend Wayne Duchesneau says, live with the earth and live with the rivers, live with the animals. And so how do we do that so that even if we're motivated by our own self-interest in survival, that's an okay way. That's an okay change agent, I think.
Okay, so we've come to the end of our time.
Oh, too bad.
Yeah, I know. We could have gone on and on, right? So I want to thank author Rebecca Claren, professors Harold Prince and Dan Rako for being on the show today. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Donna Loring, and you've been listening to Abenaki Windows. The music for our show is by Rolf Richter, a track called Little Eagles from his CD Dreamwalk. The engineers for our show are Jessica Lockhart of WMPG and John Mann of WERU. Tune in again next month for another Wabanaki Windows.